Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome to episode 43 of Cinema Attack. That's right, everybody. We're back with a brand new episode for you guys. This is the host, the most, Derek here. And as always, we have my main life mates by my side, of course. The creature feature teacher, Matt. What's going on, Matt?
Not much. What's going on, brother?
It's been crazy, you know. We got to talk about some creature last week, last time, you know. It was fucking awesome, man.
Yes, it was.
Oh, yeah. And, of course, we have the man, the myth, the legend, the producer extreme, the Donovan of podcasts, Debbie Doubles. What's going on, man?
What's up, man? That's a lot of AKAs.
It always is, man. And, you know, funny enough, you know, it was actually hilarious where I came up with your nickname of Donovan was from that episode of Fresh Cuts that we did on Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, it has that big opening.
Season of the Witch.
Yeah, the Season of the Witch, you know. And I think we kind of talked about it when we guessed it on that episode a little bit.
Yeah.
That was an epic episode. We recorded till like, I think like one or two.
Yeah, we had somebody that was involved in that that might be a part of this show.
Yeah, we have he's a co-host on two of my shows. I first met this guy when our love of kaiju came about, and you know, he's my co-host of Underwater Kaiju, and then I kind of became the third host. I was originally the fourth host, but of course I'll get more into that in a minute. But Mr. Venom is here with us, you know, my co-host from Underwater Kaiju from Outer Space and No More Room in Hell is here. What's up, Mr. Venom?
Bienvenidos, señoras y señores. We're doing this episode in all Spanish, right?
Yes, sí, señor.
All right,
yeah.
There we go.
Okay, oh, yeah. Bell.
I'm sorry, but when we start talking about my favorite director, I start to get more and more Spanish.
Don de esta la biblioteca.
Very nice.
There you go. I only know cucaracha. No, I'm just kidding. I know a few words. 7 years. You know, it's been a while since I actually had to use my Spanish, so it's a little bit rusty, but I understand a few words, so I know certain words in case somebody's talking shit or something, you know. But it's been a while since I actually had to speak it, you know what I mean? How long? That was like 15 years ago since I graduated high school. Crazy.
Yeah, well, I live in Los Angeles, so even if I wasn't born speaking it already, you kind of have to learn. It comes with the territory.
Yeah, here. Kind of with my job, too, at Home Depot. Well, when I used to work days, you know, because we used to get a lot of contractors that speak Spanish and stuff. But I got lucky. I usually get a lot of the Asian customers, unfortunately. I need the hole with the wall. I'm like, what? But Venom, you know, like I was saying, you know, No More Room in Hell. It's kind of an interesting aspect where I actually became the third host because, you know, you guys started with Corey, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. Originally, Mike's vision for the show was to kind of transfer Evil Episodes, his old podcast where they covered horror television, and basically just roll it into No More Room in Hell. I don't think Brian and Jamie were super interested in doing yet another horror movie podcast, so I think they kind of stepped away, leaving Mike and myself ready to jump in. And when we thought about who should be a third, Mike was the one who suggested Corey Graham from his 10 plus years of podcasting experience, both solo and with co-hosts. So. And he's got a spectacular voice, by the way. I like to think that I have a nice voice. Nah, man, Corey Graham got the voice right there. So, but unfortunately, real life happens, and even before this pandemic kind of took hold, Corey had to kind of step away from podcasting, deal with family matters and things like that. So, obviously, we wished him the best, and your name was just instantly one of the ones on the very short list of replacements for Corey. And I know you started out with us more as a fill-in host because Corey was kind of off and on at first.
Yeah.
But then once Corey let us know that, he probably wasn't going to be returning to the show, it just made perfect sense to have you on. I mean, you know, I love the way you talk about movies. I love your opinions. And even when you and I butt heads, it still turns into a lively but still respectful conversation. So I'm always down to work with people who show respect.
Hey, man. You know, if this would get boring if we liked everything the same. But I'll give you one thing. At least you had my back on Def Kappa.
Damn right.
You know, that was a weird episode because, you know, Don, I think I even looked at Don's letterbox and he rated it like a 4. And he's like, yeah, it wasn't that good. You know, I'm like, what? What the fuck does that mean, Don?
Yeah. Well, yeah, well, Don shocked the world this week when he guessed it on Fresh Cuts this week. And we actually looked at a more artistic horror film. It's the recently released film Relic. Which turned out to be a very, very slow burn, you know, very atmospheric. And I honestly thought Don was going to hate it. But believe it or not, he loved it more than I did. He had less problems with it than I did. And I still loved it. I thought it was one of the better allegory stories of the year. I'm not going to say what the allegory is because it's too much of a spoiler. But, yeah, if you haven't seen Relic, check it out. And I just can't believe that Don loved it as much as he did. I mean, this is a guy who says he doesn't understand how The Shining is scary. What else? Yeah, he gave The Shining like a 2 out of 10 or something. So that tells you a little bit about Don's taste. Obviously, you know, he's more into the Asian cinema and stuff like that. But, you know, when you watch an objectively great horror movie and then give it a low score because you don't get it, you know, but like I said, I love Don to death. He's a great guy, great person to podcast with, and just a very, very different person when it comes to his opinions on horror.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, even if I butt heads with Don, I still love him. He's cracks me up, especially when he says "Screehonk, everybody." That was a good impression, right?
Not bad.
But, you know, Tubby, what's going on, man? How was your week and a half since the Creature Show ended? How's it been?
It's been good, man. Been pretty chillax, honestly, man. Working at home and pandemic lifestyle, man. So it's I can't complain too much.
That's going to be their new reality show, huh? The pandemic life with Tubby Doubles, yo.
Yeah, home office, man.
Look, and I know Matt's still on the front lines there. How's it going, Matt?
Sucks, but gotta get it done. I just took a dead skunk out of my backyard today.
Oh god!
Out of the bloom, I was like, "What the hell's that smell? What's that black furry thing?" Damn. Poke it with a stick, and I realized it's a dead skunk. I'm like, "Oh, this is gonna be fun."
How'd you cook it?
Medium well.
Nice.
With a barbecue. My wife was like, "Should we burn it?" I go, "No, no, no, no."
Hey, free meat is free.
Garbage
meat.
Bag, found some woods, nice little throw, drive away fast.
Nice.
Wait until nighttime.
Oh, that's great. It's still been, you know, it's ups and downs of this whole. It's the way we just gotta live with it. I guess the way I look at it is. I just been buying a lot of movies and shit. I'm like, at least I get to do that. You know, I could order a movie, get it in. As long as I get my gamer box, I don't give a fuck what's going on outside right now, you know?
Yeah.
You know,
I pre-ordered it, so I'm excited. I can't wait.
Oh, I actually, this is weird because I actually, you know, I get like the MVD. I used to get the MVD screeners. You know, not like the actual, like, Arrow videos themselves, but, like, the little slimline cases.
Mm-hmm.
I got a giant box in the mail, and it's the little screeners of the Gamera set.
Oh, wow.
So, I was like, I gotta watch these. I'm like, it was bad, because I was supposed to start prepping for this show. I was actually gonna start prepping for this Wednesday, and I ended up watching, like, 10 hours of Gamera.
Whoops.
Oh, so good. The transfers are like, oh my god, the transfer on Attack on Legion, holy shit, that's fucking spectacular. Oh, and it's just cool because when I look at this set, when I'm looking at the special features, and like it has like, every movie has like a commentary track with people I actually know in the kaiju community. Like Attack on Legion has a commentary track with Kyle Yant, who is the host of the Kaiju Cast for years, and I'm like when you look at this set that's coming out next to like that Criterion Showa set, it's like, fuck you, Toho. Like, Jesus Christ. You know, like, it's insane, because Toho's so anal what they want to give companies to use, and this is like all commentary tracks from like Steve Rifle and Ed Gankowski. I probably butchered the fuck out of that last name. It's just a weird name. But, you know, they do a comedy track on Revenge of Iris. I'm like, this is fucking great. Like, two of the best Godzilla historians on one of the best Gamera movies of all time. You know, it's like crazy. It's like, and of course, this is all part of Matt Frank, who actually is the co-producer of this project and did like all the artwork. He did artwork for every movie, and every menu screen's his artwork. And it's just great. It's just great that the Arrow Video actually reached out to Matt Frank, and he reached out to all these other guys to do commentary tracks for these films. It's great. I actually just listened to an interview with him recently on the Monsters vs. Men episode when they covered Gamera vs. Guiron. And it's funny. He cracks me up. Like, he's like, one of the hosts was like reminiscing about like a movie he saw about, like, I think it's about astronauts that land on a planet with dinosaurs, and he's like, Planet of the Dinosaurs, right? He's like, yeah, that might have been it. Oh, it's fucking terrible when it's half the people are just fucking walking through the planet for most of the movie.
Yeah, but those chicks were nice to look at.
They were. It's just a weird movie. Like, I actually remember watching that as a kid, and I'm thinking, like, yeah, there's dinosaurs, but then there's a lot of them scenes walking to this weird, like, music. Like, it's just cool and shit. And he's just talking about, he reached out to all these people and shit. And then they reviewed Gamera vs. Guiron, and that review cracked me up. It's a good show. I listen to a lot of different stuff over the week. And it's good. And actually, another note concerning Matt Frank recently, I actually got back into reading. I'm actually reading a book by Jeremy Robinson, who's actually an author from my area right now, called Project Nemesis. It's the first book in his Nemesis saga, which is, they're kaiju thrillers, pretty much. So it's about kaijus and stuff, and Matt Frank actually did all the illustrations for, he actually designed the monsters on the cover, and it looks pretty awesome. But yeah, it's cool. He actually, Jeremy Robinson actually, for like a, you know how authors usually do like a special thanks, he actually thanked Channel 56, the show, the double creature feature back in the day. And that's crazy, because I used to watch that too. It's like one of those things, like, oh, I'm like putting two and two together, like, oh, this guy's from my area. Like, just crazy. But, you know, I've been working. Working's always fun.
Right.
Always?
Always. You know, you gotta have that positive attitude when you go into work, you know? Especially when you have to... Well, we don't really get to see this yet, because that's the only good thing about my job is we work nights, so we don't have to deal with customers and shit. We actually had to take a class recently, because we had to do, like, some training classes, where if somebody approaches you that doesn't wear a mask and how to comply, so you stay safe, pretty much, because it's
getting... Spray them in the face with a water bottle? No mask. Back.
No, pretty much just give them good customer service. I'm like, thank God I work nights. You know, it's just crazy in that aspect. You know, I thought it was just crazy when they started putting the face, the glass shields up. I'm like, oh my God, this is like fucking like a post-apocalyptic movie I used to watch as a kid or something. Like, it's whatever. We're just going to live and just wait it out. That's all you can do. You know, I'll get to go see Wonder Woman in 2 years, but it'll be worth it at that time.
Hell yeah, man. I can't wait to see The New Mutants in 2024.
That movie has the shittiest fucking luck of movies.
Really?
First they're going to recut it, make it R-rated and shit, and then you know, Disney bought Fox and it got pulled again. And finally going to be released. Fuck you, COVID-19 said, and like, fuck you, New Mutants. I love that, like, fake article where it showed, like, the cast and they de-aged them to make them look older. We finally got to see the movie. Like, 2835 or something. Fucking fucked up. But that's enough about that jibber-jabbish, man. You know, last time, Venom was actually on the infamous Herschel Gordon Lewis episode too. I just remember that. That was a interesting aspect of that show, man.
And I've since watched the documentary directed by Frank Henenlotter, Godfather of Gore, right?
Yeah.
I watched that like maybe a month after I did that appearance on your show because I had never seen it, and man, am I glad I did. I loved it.
It's such a great doc, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, this is another director spotlight, and the reason why I asked Venom to come, and he made sure that he could make it, because the faiths aligned. Guillermo del Toro is one of your favorite directors. Is that right, Venom?
He is my absolute favorite director. Obviously, you know, I'm a horror guy, so obviously I still... give all respect to the masters of horror, the Cravens, the Carpenters, the Hoovers, but it's just something about Guillermo's storytelling has always spoken to me, regardless of the film. It could be a flat-out horror film like Mimic, or it could be a practically a love story like The Shape of Water. It's just all his films have spoken to me on so many levels that... Yeah, I absolutely love the man. And anytime he does an appearance out here in L.A., I always make a point to see him. The last time I saw him was in 2018 when he was showing off a bunch of his artwork at the Creature Features gallery in Burbank, California. So, yeah, I never miss an opportunity to see him. And thus far, I love every single movie he's ever made. So he's batting 1,000 for me.
Nah, I love a lot of his movies too, man. Even I know Mimic had a lot of studio involvement with it, and you know, he even stated that in the past. I still like it, but you can definitely tell, like, especially if you watch the regular cut of it, that you can see like all the studio involvement and what he went through with the Weinsteins and shit with that one. I still like it though, you know. It's
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a great director is going to shine through studio interference.
Yeah.
You know, no matter how much studio interference people like, you know, Coppola or Spielberg, you know, no matter what kind of studio interference they got, they still put out great movies. It may not be the vision, the full vision that they had while filming, but at least they were able to put out something of high quality. And, you know, that's kind of the same thing with Guillermo. A great director's skills are going to shine through regardless of how much studio crap is thrown at him. So, love him.
Yeah, I do too. Plus, his favorite horror movie is like my favorite horror movie, Zombie. He loves that movie.
So he's a big Italian fan for sure. And you can see that influence, which I love about him as well.
When's the last first time you experienced Del Toro, man? And what do you think about him as a director?
I mean, he's definitely one of my favorite modern directors. I would think Pan's Labyrinth was probably the first time I actually saw him, and then I went back and saw his older work and kept with it. You know, I've loved Hellboy, I've loved Blade 2, pretty much everything he's done as well. I just think he's such a creative guy, man. You know, not just as a director, you know, writer, and just his creature designs. I mean, he's the way he dips into this fantasy, and then he has like a steampunk gothic style that I just love, man. I love Del Toro.
Yeah, and speaking of his effects, he did study under the master Dick Smith, so it totally makes sense.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, I actually, what show did I listen to recent? It was one of the shows. It was either The Movies That Made Me or what was the other one? The show with Elijah Wood, did Visitations. It was either one of those I was listening to, and he was mentioning, like, Mean Dick Smith and stuff for the first time ever, and it was like, that's fucking crazy and awesome at the same time, because I never knew that until I listened to that show, you know? So, that's a cool fact to know, so, you know. Matt, what about you, man? I know you're a huge fan of a lot of the creature feature stuff, and I know you love Mimic.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I got into Del Toro back in the 90s with Kronos first, and then I got into him with Mimic afterwards. Now, I loved Mimic. I had the director's cut. I watched the director's cut all the time. I don't want to watch the normal cut. I think it gets ruined. But when you watch the director's cut, it's so much better. And, mm-hmm. of course, watching Kronos, I fucking love that movie. I remember watching it when I was younger, the whole different type of vampire-type movie, which we'll be talking about later on. And the love between the grandfather and the granddaughter. She thinks she'll be scarred for life, but she's like, nope, I love my grandfather no matter what. So it shows like a big bonding type film. And then, of course, later on you get to his other films. And I loved Hellboy. And I actually liked Hellboy Part 2 as well. The newer one was kind of, well, it wasn't Del Toro, but was okay. But Pan's Labyrinth was my first time watching when we talk about it. And I definitely loved it. It was a great fairy tale-esque flick. And I love how he puts his twists on everything in those movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, for myself, I think actually it might have been Blade 2. It was the first one I remember seeing in theater, so that might be the first one of his films I actually remember seeing. You know, like actually seeing, remembering it was Guillermo del Toro, that kind of. I might have seen, like, some of his earlier stuff before, but I just didn't know, like, it was him, like, Mimic, maybe. I might have seen Mimic first, if I remember, but it could have been either that or Blade 2, because those are, like, the two first, like, American ones that he did. So they could either go hand in hand. And then I got more into his stuff, and, of course, one aspect of a few of his movies, especially one that we're going to talk about, he casts Ron Perlman in a lot of his stuff.
Yeah.
And I love Ron.
Sam Jackson.
It is. And the thing that, like, he loves every genre of movies. You can just tell from everything that he does. It's just so cool in that aspect where he could go and make a dark fantasy movie. He could go and make a fucking kaiju movie later on with Pacific Rim, you know? And it's just, the career is just insane. It really is. And, you know, he should have won an Oscar years ago. This is, you know, he got his Paul Newman Oscar at fucking Shape of Water.
And deservedly so, though.
Yeah, it's a great movie. But one of the movies we're going to talk about tonight, he should have won Best Director.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, that movie came out in a time when foreign films weren't really, you know, winning Best Picture at the Oscars.
That's true, too.
Yeah, I mean, if he would have put Pan out, I don't know, like in the mid to late 2010s, I think the world would have recognized the genius right away and potentially, at the very least, gotten a nomination.
For real, for sure, man. And a thing that I, you know, the films that we did pick, we picked three different films from, like, three different periods of his films. We picked a film from the 90s, we picked a film from the 2000s, and we picked a film from the 2010s. So, I think this is a good junket of things that he's done in his career that we picked.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, different styles, and, you know, we got one film that has English and American mix. We'll get more into that in that review. My first time watching it, because we'll get into that in a minute. But and then we have one film just straight out Spanish production, no, like, English dialogue at all. Even though there's actually a American actor playing like one of the main like things in it, but we'll talk about that in a minute. And then of course, you know, and then full blown like Hollywood movie, so it's cool that we pick a little bit of variety with these reviews and movies, and they're all different.
Absolutely, yes.
So you ready to get into it, Venom?
And guys, oh please, yes,
yes.
So we will play you the trailer for the first movie of the night, and we will be back with our homie Dubby Doubles. He's starting again, man. What the hell, Dub?
Let's do it.
You know, we're going to be back with Kronos in a minute, guys, so we'll be right back after these messages.
What is up, y'all? We are back for the first film of the night, our director's spotlight of Guillermo del Toro. We're starting off with his very first, at least, full-length feature, and that is Kronos from 1993. Basic plot on this one, antique dealer Jesus stumbles across Kronos, a 400-year-old scarab that, when it latches onto him, grants him youth and eternal life. But also a thirst for blood. As Jesus enjoys his newfound vitality, he's unaware that a dying old man, Dieter, messed that up, but has sent his nephew, Angel, played by Ron Perlman, to find the scarab and bring it back to him. So yeah, that's pretty much the basic plot on this one. Like I said, I didn't see this film initially, so I went back and sought this out after I became a fan of Del Toro. And I have to say, I'm pretty damn impressed for a first film, pretty damn awesome. I mean, characters and everything overall, really fresh take on the vampire, you could argue, vampire outlook, kind of like a Martin take. What's your guys' initial thoughts and history with this one?
I'll go first. Yeah, I actually haven't seen, I didn't see this right away either. You know, I saw the Criterion one time in the Criterion sale. Of course, shout out to Barnes & Nobles.
Somebody got them on.
Yeah. And, you know, I love the artwork that's used on the actual Criterion set. It's done by actually connection to Hellboy, Mike Mignola. Is that how you pronounce it? Am I getting there?
I think so.
Yeah, you know, the guy who did the Hellboy illustrations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was like this weird middle, like, fucking gold fucking beetle thing, and then fucking blood dripping out of the mechanics. I'm like, this looks cool. So I took it home, put it on, and I gotta say it right off the bat, Ron Perlman is fucking awesome in this fucking movie. I love his character so much. I love that he's obsessed with his nose. It's just so weird and great at the same time.
Have you guys noticed kind of a trend with Guillermo's villains over most of his movies? A lot of them are vain. You know, they dress proper. They make sure their hair is perfect, blah, blah, blah. It's funny because, you know, Guillermo is kind of a big, scruffy guy. I wonder if he just looks at beautiful people as evil inherent.
Yeah, especially in the last movie. We'll talk about that later. But, yeah, I just love that character. And this is a fucking cool take on pretty much just a different take on vampirism that you'd never seen before. And I was like,
yeah,
this is fucking cool. It's kind of got some crazy, like, crazy metal bug that turns you into a vampire. What the fuck? This is great.
And it's actually a bug inside the bug.
Yeah.
That was kind of neat.
I love
like
that.
A big bug kick.
Yeah, that effect was so cool, too. Like, when you go inside to the machine, it was like, this is weird and cool at the same time. I always dug the shit out of this one after I seen it for the first time. Oh, man. Good shit.
Oh, yeah. As far as I go, I didn't see Kronos the year it came out. I think the first movie of the first Guillermo movie I saw first run would have been Mimic. And I really, really enjoyed Mimic. I didn't necessarily think that it was like a masterpiece of directing by any stretch, but I do remember thinking, you know, this guy might have a pretty good future. And then somebody turned me on to Kronos, which was his first movie. And that's the one that really turned me on to him. Like, you see the subtle nuances that he does in his films, both with his villains and his heroes. One of the major things, too, that I love about Guillermo's movies is his use of objects and how they either interact or affect characters on the screen. Obvious examples of that would be the pen in Crimson Peak, the prosthetic leg in Devil's Backbone, the watch in Pan's Labyrinth, and then in this film, the Kronos device itself. And I just love that kind of the way that he uses storytelling to not just tell the story of the people that are in the movie, but to tell the story of the objects themselves. Like, all the objects that I just listed in their individual movies have stories behind them. And I love that. He creates a mythology for his items that will later either help or hurt characters in the movie. So I've just always been a huge fan of that. But as far as the first time I saw Kronos, like I said, I walked away from the VCR thinking, yeah, this guy's got a really bright future. He can make Hollywood horror movies like Mimic, but then he can make legitimately heartfelt artistic horror like Kronos. And for someone who can do that, along with all the other stuff that he later also developed in his film career, the man's a master, in my opinion. So, yeah. But I remember finishing Kronos the first time and thinking, wow, that was a really interesting take on the vampire lore, though I wish they would have done more. Every time I watch this film, I always feel like there's more to the story to tell. I would have liked to have known more about De La Guardia. I would have liked to have known more about Mercedes, Aurora, just all the different people in the film. A lot of them kind of came in and left. And unfortunately, of course, with his granddaughter not really speaking, it's kind of hard for her to convey, you know, kind of what's going through her head, especially as a young actress. But mm-hmm. I still think she did a great job. What was the actress's name? Tamara Shenoff, I believe, or Tamara. Tamara Shenoff. I think her performance in this movie is great without saying almost anything throughout the whole film. And again, Guillermo has a special ability with his characters that don't speak. I mean, you know, think about Santi from The Devil's Backbone. He has characters in his film that can tell an entire story with just a single look. And that, again, it just kind of taps more into the brilliance of Del Toro's direction. Yeah, please, somebody jump in here and stop me, because I'm going to keep talking for 3 hours.
I just want to comment to like what something you said. Like, you're kind of right, because like I even want like the whole like prequel movie about the alchemist in this, because that whole backstory, how he created the Kronos, and then we just see that single shot of him.
Yeah, as, Bear like, Cruz.
You know, like I want to see like a whole movie of just that story too in this.
As long as it doesn't take place in outer space, we're okay. Like Hellraiser 4 did. You get the history of it, and all of a sudden you're in outer space. I love the design of the Kronos Scarab.
Yes.
I thought that was an awesome look. How it's like you wind it up, the legs stick out, and you're like, oh, that's interesting. But then all of a sudden it clamps onto them, and then this stinger comes out of nowhere, which also leaves stingers in you as well. And that's how it drains the blood out of you or somehow, but turns you into your vampire, craving more blood and turning your skin. The whole ripping of the skin off in the movie was insane. You would think that the little girl would be completely, oh my god, I turned off. Nope. She didn't care. She loved her grandfather. She knew who her grandfather was going to be and everything and kept pushing on. All the other kids nowadays would be like, fuck this, I'm out of here. My grandfather's turning into a monster. Run away.
It's you know, the thing that I like about the Kronos device, it kind of acts like a drug. Because he keeps wanting and keeps it from himself.
He's
got to
get his fix.
And, you know, it's kind of... I got brain damage vibes from it, you know?
Yes!
You know, like, every time he wanted this to get injected with that little fucking thing, you know?
You know, I never made the comparison, definitely.
When the scene in the bathroom, he's finally getting his blood fixed. He's actually in a tux, laying on the bathroom floor of all places, a public bathroom, licking blood off. He's like,
"Oh, that was so gross."
Oh, it's so good. And then after that scene, Ron Perlman just beats the shit out and just throws him.
Ron Perlman's character was hysterical in this.
I loved it. And then he gets his nose broken. And he's like, "Oh."
Not again with the nose.
It's just he's always curious about his nose. That's what this character kept me intrigued. I'm like, what? He brought those little measuring things at different nose sizes. Which one do you like? That one.
Oh, that was a great scene. I love that. Even the, you know, there's not a whole lot of comedy in this film, but the little bits that we get are on point, and that scene is great.
And we haven't even talked about the guy who plays Jesus. He's fucking great in it, too, because you just see his change after the Kronos device. Like, he had a mustache. He was a very older-looking man. Mm-hmm. Then right after, he gets stabbed with it, and, you know, he starts to shave.
Suave.
Yeah. Younger.
He's like, I want to take my girl out to dance, you know?
Thanks, bruh.
I'm going to introduce the other bad guy there, the guy with a very rare disease.
Oh, yeah, the Ron Perlman's uncle, he has, like, I love that scene where he first, like, that Jesus first meets him, and fucking, he's like, every part of me is in this jar, in this case. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
He reminded me of another actor. He kind of looked like a Danny Boyle type.
Kind of remind me of Silence of the Lambs, like Hannibal Lecter.
Kinda. Mixed with like the guy from Creepshow, the last story there with the cockroaches, because he's in like this health room.
Definitely plays a good bad guy.
Right.
Well, he had two canes too. Like he's like, I can't walk.
That was cool. He had on the walls, he had all the bagged statues. All lined up, all the way around. Like you could tell how long he was going after this particular statue. He knew it was in there, but he just didn't know which one it was.
And the greatest scene ever is like when we first meet Ron Perlman and him, and he's like, "I need you to redo your will. put me on your will right now."
Let's talk about the score for a second. Did you guys notice how the score in this movie is like all over the world? Like the very opening music sounds French. Later in the movie, there's a song that sounds Italian. Later in the movie, there's a song that sounds just kind of traditional American soundtrack music. But yeah, I was noticing that this the score of this movie has a lot of different flavors from around the world. You know, potentially, you know, Guillermo in his travels. I know this was his first movie, but I do know he had left the country multiple times before he started directing. So it definitely seems like he picked up some things, whether he picked them up from actually being there or just picked them up from watching other classic films. But yeah, I really appreciate that about the score, because he could have easily just gone with a traditional Mexican score. You know, this movie's 100% Mexican, shot there. You know, he's Mexican, obviously. He could have just given this, like, a Tejano, you know, or merengue fucking soundtrack. But no, he decides to kind of dip into multiple pots. And, yeah, it, which just makes for a very, what's the word I'm looking for? Just like an all-over-the-place soundtrack.
Eclectic, yeah.
Eclectic, thank you, yes. And it all works. In every scene, you know, where he's got where the music takes focus, it works. You know, no matter where the music sounds like it comes from, whether it sounds French, sounds Italian, sounds American. And yeah, once again, just, you know, another little subtle nuance of Guillermo that I absolutely love.
And I mean, it's always tasteful too, as you said, but mm-hmm. This one especially, it was almost like an elegance thing. I mean, it just felt... elegant, I guess, you know, yeah. The whole antique vibe and the ballroom vibe, like everything just felt, you know, mm-hmm. rich, if you will.
Absolutely.
Yeah, maybe on my first watch, it was like, wait, what the hell is this music? But, you know, watching it now, I'm like thinking, like, yeah, the soundtrack, because every piece of scene that the music's in, it works in those scenes, you know, it's not like, didn't jar me on this watch, but like first time I'm like, what the hell am I watching? Or like a Roberto Benigni movie? What the fuck's this music? You know, like, you know, but I dig it. It's cool. I like it. It's funny.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That was also too with the subtitles. It goes from English to Spanish to all over the place. Is my thing broke?
Yeah, that was the first time I actually saw this. I'm like, oh, this movie's not all in Spanish. This is crazy and weird.
I wasn't expecting Ron Perlman on that, too.
Yeah, Ron Perlman's talking good Spanish in it.
Yeah, not a bad Spanish speaker at all, actually, for, you know, for being so young in his career. I don't know where Ron Perlman's from. If he's from, like, Los Angeles, then it might make a little bit more sense. But if he's from anywhere else in the country, that means he had to, like, sit down and learn the language. So, yeah, kudos for him.
I know he could speak French, too, because he did a few Jeannot films.
Nice. Like
Children of the Lost Paradise. Mm-hmm. He's actually in that. He speaks French throughout it. Yeah, I could go on. Like, what do you guys feel about like the actual ending? Do you think it's kind of open ended? And what do you guys think about that?
Either A, they accept him for what he is, or they're actually going to let him go to rest because, you know, he's laying in bed. The sun's coming up. We all know what happens to vampires and sun. Mm-hmm. So they're like going to put him at rest now, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. Ultimately, vampirism is a curse. I mean, you know, we like to look at it, you know, kind of sexualized and glorified as, ooh, I get to live forever and I get to look the same way I do now, blah, blah, blah. So, but we never think about the actual, you know, the cons to this. And, you know, living forever may sound cool, but God forbid there's like a nuclear disaster and you're left alone on the planet because your dumbass wanted to be immortal. You know, so there's so much to think about with, you know, the choice of wanting to partake in vampirism. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I dig that too about it. It could either be either or. I dig that.
Mm-hmm.
For real, man. W, what about you? You've been... what's going on? What did you think about the end?
I mean... You know, I kind of thought of it as a way of him basically self-sacrificing, basically, basically for his granddaughter, I think,
mm-hmm.
because, I mean, he was having those temptations, and I think he overcame them. So, I thought that was just a sacrifice that, you know, he's ultimately making for his family. It's kind of how I took the ending, but mm-hmm. as you said, I mean, they left it open for interpretation for a reason, no doubt.
Yeah. For real, and I forgot to mention, like, the funniest scene ever. Like, when he first, like, because, you know, after Ron Perlman thinks he kills him. You know, I love that whole scene where, you know, he, like, being cremated, and, you know, he's not being cremated, he's being sewn up, and they're like, oh, he's gonna be cremated, why didn't you tell me before I started doing this shit? You know, they're all fighting, like, what the hell, why are you wasting my time? I was, like, cracking up, and, you know, they put the suit on him backwards.
That was cool, though, he's walking around with the suit backwards to them. To the end of the movie.
Yeah.
That was kind of neat.
I like the whole reborn aspect he was kind of going through, where he basically started to become like the alchemist.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which was fucking really cool. And as they peel off the skin, you know, he's just ghostly white underneath.
Yeah. And, man... The thing that really strikes me about this movie and its vampire aspects are just the fact that the Scarab basically will turn you into a bloodsucker, because, you know, through its sting. Mm-hmm. And I just found that it was just so different. But the other thing that really struck me about it is the fact that these guys can live a long time and they have to drink blood, but they don't get any other vampire powers. Like, nobody's super strong, nobody can turn into a bat, you know, they never show anybody standing in front of a mirror, so it's like Guillermo picked and chose which, you know, classic vampire tropes he was going to use, and I think he picked the most compelling ones, because, you know, obviously you want to be a vampire if you're going to be as strong as the Hulk afterwards, but if you're just going to be the same old man, but all you're getting is a little bit of an extended life... That's a decision that, you know, a lot of different people, you know, would go one way or the other. I'm not even sure what I would do if I was put in that situation. But especially the closer you are to your mortality, the more you want to live longer. The older we get, the less we want to die. And that's kind of a weird dichotomy for humanity. But, you know, it's the sad truth. So in a sense... It makes sense that this old guy would want to live longer, but then in another way, it doesn't make sense, because you're not a young man. You're going to live as an old man for the rest of your days. So what's the appeal there? So
He didn't even want it, too. He's like, I want this cured. I'll give you the Scarab if you cure me. I don't want this. He didn't. Where others, like the main bad guy, did want it. He wanted to live forever.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it's so good. I guess we're getting
some ratings?
Absolutely.
Who do you want to go first, Dub?
Let's have our guest, Mr. Venom.
All right, well, I mean, what can I say about this movie? For a first time effort from a new director, this thing is absolutely gorgeous. It works on a lot of levels. It's beautiful, it's heartfelt, and ultimately this movie it just gives you a sign of things to come from Guillermo. Because more so than Mimic, I think this movie shows us, you know, kind of the beginning of the path that Guillermo's going to go down in, you know, while doing his movies. All of his movies, whether they're horror, romance, action, they all have a common element, and that's fantasy. And there's a fantasy element in every single one of his movies, regardless of its main genre. And anybody who can mix fantasy with a fucking romance, I mean, that's pretty epic right there. But with this movie, like I said, we see the blueprint of what will one day become one of the greatest directors that we've had. I'm going to come into Kronos. I do have some minor issues with it, though. Sometimes there's some pacing issues, especially in the second act. But for the most part, performances are great. Score is great. Editing, cinematography. I mean, there's very little that you can complain about this particular movie. But only because I know how strong his future films are going to be, I'm going to go ahead and give Kronos... you guys do 5 or 10-point scales?
10-point.
I'm going with an 8.5 out of 10.
Nice, man. So, what about Derek?
Yeah, I always dug Kronos, man. It's kind of a fun film, and it's every time I watch it, it gets better, in my opinion. Like, it's just so good. And Ron Perlman, I love Ron Perlman. I love him to death. Like, when we did the Last Winter Venom on No More Room in Hell, you know, it was fucking great. And, you know, in that movie, and it's always great to see how he brings, like, different characters to the table, and they're iconic. And this one, oh, man, so good. Oh, love the effects. I love the little scarab beetle. I do kind of agree that maybe some little tad pacing issues, but overall, I still enjoy this film. It's a great first-time effort from a first-time director, and it shows you what he's going to bring in the future with his future projects. So I'd probably give this like an 8.5 as well. I agree with that. Good stuff.
What say you, creature feature teacher?
I pretty much agree with Venom and Derek. There's not much to say what they've already said. So I also give this one an 8.5 out of 10. I did enjoy this. This was like my first Del Toro flick. I remember watching this later, like in the late 90s. I think this came out like... did this come out in 93?
Yes.
Yeah. So it must have been later, before like Mimic and everything. I remember renting it on VHS. And I'm like, wow, this is a really weird vampire flick. And, of course, at the time, I'm like, oh, great, I had to read. When I was a lot younger, I didn't like subtitled films, but I sat there and sucked it up and watched it. Still loved it. I was like, wow, this is mind-blowing. I love how it takes place, where everything occurs, and how dark and deep it can get. So, yeah, 8.5 out of 10.
Nice. Yeah, so, I mean... I'm just a sucker for any kind of original take, especially on vampires, because Martin, one of my all-time favorites. So, I mean, this one definitely does its own thing here. Love the relationship and just overall dynamic between the granddaughter and grandfather, man. I mean, it's just cool to see how that plays out, and she sees the changes of her grandfather, and it's just nice, man. It's heartwarming how it all plays out, for sure. Side note, definitely check out the Criterion edition of this, Geometria. It has its first, student film. Fantastic short film. Definitely has like 80s demons, Lamberto Bava vibe to me anyway. It's really fun. Definitely check that one out. But yeah, man, I'm right there with you guys on this one as well. It's fantastic. It's hard to believe this is like his first film. I'm going 8.5 as well. That's good Brady.
Now, that the short, is it out on physical release or is it online?
It's on the Criterion release.
Yeah, it's on the bonus. Is it on the Criterion?
I didn't really pay attention. I saw a documentary, but I didn't see.
So it's like, what, 12 minutes or something? I think it's. I mean, it's pretty short, but cool. It's fun. Fun little flick, man.
Do I pay attention to special features?
Well, to be fair, the Criterion and Arrow usually write their special features very tiny.
Yeah.
We'll get more into those later. But, good shit. I think we should take a little break, play you the trailer for the next movie, and Matt will be back with the big one, Pan's Labyrinth.
Ooh.
So we'll be back in a few.
In a dark time, when hope was bleak, there lived a young girl whose only escape was in a legend that wanted her back. The legend speaks of the lost soul of a princess from another world who will one day be reborn. There will be signs that mark her return. Secrets that reveal her destiny. There will be a journey Pan's Labyrinth.
And welcome back, everybody. Here we are with part two of our Del Toro show, and now we're talking about Pan's Labyrinth from 2006, also known as El Libreto del Fauno. And this one's takes place in 1944, pretty much in the Falganis, Spain. The bookish young stepdaughter of a sadistic army officer escapes into an eerie but captivating fantasy world. This was like a first time watch for me. How about you guys?
I saw this movie opening weekend when it came out, in America anyway. I think it came out a couple of weeks after its Mexican and Spain release. But yeah, by 2006, Guillermo was already on his way to becoming my favorite director. So when I heard and saw the trailer, you know, that he's doing another fantasy fairy tale movie based around the Spanish Civil War, I was on board instantly. I mean, Devil's Backbone is probably my favorite Guillermo movie. I'm not necessarily saying it's his best. It's obviously not his best, but it's a personal favorite of mine. And I had just seen it a couple of years before I saw the trailer for Pan. So yeah, as soon as I saw the trailer, I was on board. I believe I saw it twice opening weekend.
Wow.
I didn't see this in theaters, and I could have probably, but I saw the trailer for this. I'm like, what is this crazy looking movie? It looks fucking awesome. This is my stoner years, of course. I'm like, yeah, man, this fairies, insects turn into fairies and shit. You know, this is me, my stoner me talking. So I saw it when it came out on regular home video. And man, this story was fucking deep. Too deep at the time, I don't think I really appreciated it back then, but on rewatch and future rewatches, like, wow, this movie, the story hit me hard sometimes, and you know, it brings a tear. And I gotta give big credit for the main actress who plays the little girl, Ivana Baquero. Is that how you pronounce that, Ivana?
Baquero.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Matt actually just saw her in The New Daughter. She's the daughter in The New Daughter, the same actress.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and great performance, and I got to give big ups to the man, Doug Jones, in this movie too, man, who plays the Fawn and the Pale Man. Such a great, versatile guy that could do makeup roles, and he was great.
He uses the same character. He used Doug Jones in Hellboy.
He's used Doug Jones in almost everything.
Yeah, right? Doug Jones is in the next movie, too, that we're going to talk about.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and him and what's the name of the guy who played, what's that called? Fucking, you know, the guy who played the leopard in It. What's his name? You know, he was Mama, Javier Baquet?
Oh, yeah, Baudet, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ironically enough, those two actually shared, I talked about this on the Rec show. Harvey Baquet played him in Rec, you know, the big guy at the end of Rec, and then Doug Jones played him in the remake Quarantine, and that's actually the only thing that's good about the fucking remake Quarantine of Rec. Because that movie fucking sucks on rewatch. Holy shit. But I always dug this for those aspects alone. And it's a great movie, and I might have to... Del Toro should have won an Oscar for Best Director for this, because even in, like, the intro, like, he almost killed himself making this movie. He drove himself and lost, like, 40 pounds and shit. Like, he went through hell making this movie.
Yeah, I mean, this was his passion project. This was a movie that he had been planning for over 10 years. He never thought that he would get the clout in the film industry and, you know, just the big enough name to be able to get the money he would need to do this. From what I understand, he wasn't happy with the amount of money that he got to make this movie with, but he did the best that he could with what he had, and here it is. And you can't deny the man's skills. If he can take $14 million and turn it into Pan's Labyrinth, that's practically magic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure.
And we definitely get a lot of magic in this.
Oh, yeah. I was thinking, so that's fitting, man. Magic is sums this up.
Nope.
I mean, I love just this. I mean, it's sci-fi fantasy, but he's pulling all these other influences. I mean, from Spanish Civil War to Greek mythology. I mean, it's just wild how he's pulling all this up and making his own little universe. I mean, you can tell it's his passion project. There's just such a deep universe going on here, and you have multiple stories going on, really. A fairy tale within a fairy tale, in a way.
A fairy tale within a nightmare.
Yeah, within a very dark fairy tale. Yeah.
There you go.
Oh, yeah, man, fucking... Oh, I hate the fucking captain so much every time I watch this movie.
That's what makes him so great. The fact that as soon as he's on screen, his very fucking first line is complaining about his wife and her daughter being 15 minutes late. I mean, instantly he sets himself up as the major douchebag of this movie. But that's the thing about Guillermo's villains, man. He makes them so despicable that you fucking hate them, but... If you take a second to think, it's like, oh man, that guy's performance is great. Because I don't know him, I shouldn't hate him, but I do. Like when I see Captain Vidal, I throw up in my mouth a little bit every time, and it's like that's the reaction that Guillermo gets from viewers at watching his villains. And yeah, I mean that's part of why I've always said that movies are made for the villain. You have to have a compelling villain more than a compelling hero to give us a good movie. And Guillermo, once again, I'm using the word master. I'm going to be saying that a lot here. But, I mean, he is the master of casting his villains. And as long as he continues to do that, I mean, right up until Shape of Water, the guy in Shape of Water is fucking disgusting and a prick.
So, yeah, perfectly. On a side note, perfectly casted by Michael Shannon too.
Exactly.
Right. And this guy, I kind of get what you mean with the vein thing, because now that I'm thinking about looking at it, like this movie, like he's always shaving and cleaning himself up and rubbing his shoe. He has to always be clean and all right and proper. And you're right.
Looking in the mirror. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, and they always go out of their way to make sure too. Like think about The Devil's Backbone. The antagonist in The Devil's Backbone is just another one of the orphans there. He's just one of the older orphans that's been there for a while. But you can even see him. He'll go out of his way to make sure that his shirt is perfectly tucked in, that his belt is, wrung perfectly, that his shirt looks right, that his hair looks right. I mean, these guys are so vain that sometimes they'll just forget how evil they are because they're busy looking at themselves. And I that's just another aspect of Guillermo's villains that I absolutely love. His heroes are humble and his villains are vain, and that's perfect.
Yeah.
And the biggest thing about his villains is his creatures, man.
Yes.
Some of the best looking creatures, I mean, the past 20 years easily. I mean, amazing creature design.
Yep.
The Pale Man, I mean, as the Fawn, I mean, just beautiful. And a lot of that's practical effects, too.
Most of it, yeah.
Yeah.
And even, like, the mixture of CGI, it actually works in this film. It adds, like, the fantasy element.
Definitely. It's never jarring or just feels like a video game. Like, because I'm the first one to complain about CG, but it's really good. Well done in this
film. Yeah, it's definitely not Dragon Wars CGI.
I love it how he actually makes a war movie into a fantasy movie and combines the two.
I mean,
he already took a war movie and made it into a ghost story, so
yeah.
Who knows, maybe his next war movie he'll turn it into like a, I don't know, some kind of action blockbuster.
Guillermo del Toro presents Fast and Furious 20.
Pan plane.
Oh, man.
Ron Perlman's just cast as the bad guy. I'm like, yes.
Best Doug Jones plays one of the cars.
Just pretending to making car sounds as he drives.
The Pacific Rim robot comes out of nowhere. I'm here to race you. Oh no.
You just made Fast and Furious better than ever was before.
That's the truth.
And then the giant robot is the creature from Shape of Water and Pan the Fawn together, working together to move the robot.
Damn, Doug Jones is going to get multiple roles in this movie, you're saying. So you just made
a Doug Jones movie.
Oh, and you guys, I'm not sure if you guys are aware, you guys realize that Pan's Labyrinth and The Devil's Backbone share a universe? It's very hard to notice if you're not really paying attention. Do you guys remember the five orphans that survived The Devil's Backbone?
Uh-huh.
I haven't seen
all
The Devil's
five
Backbone
of them,
in years.
All five of them are in this movie. They're shot by Vidal.
Oh, wow.
The scene where the soldier who keeps grabbing Vidal's gun and pushing it aside, that's the main kid from Devil's Backbone. They have the same name.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, this is a shared universe.
Damn, you just made Devil's Backbone even more depressing.
Oh, big time, exactly.
Oh, fuck. That's cool.
This movie. Pardon me a second, co-hosts and listeners, because I'm going to suck this movie's dick for a couple minutes here. This movie is the sheer definition of a masterpiece. There, in my personal opinion, there is zero wrong with this movie. From cinematography, direction, score, set design, costume design, sound design, just everything in this movie is damn near perfect. Now, you can make an argument that sometimes the CG on the fairies maybe didn't hold up as well, but Derek made the perfect point. This is a fucking fantasy movie. If it doesn't look real, ha! It's not supposed to. It's fantasy. Yeah. So,
right.
Yeah, so, I mean, like I said, this movie has been just a near perfect movie for me. I watched this movie twice this week with the express reason of trying to find something I don't like about the movie. And guess what? Two viewings this week, I can't think of a single thing I would change. So yeah, this is Guillermo's masterpiece. Yes, he won his Oscar for Shape of Water. Before we recorded, we were talking about that he deserved the Oscar nomination for this one. He was nominated for screenwriting. Unfortunately, he didn't win. But yeah, this movie, you know, just like a lot of the great foreign movies that didn't win the Oscars they should have, this one just once again, because it's not in English, American audiences aren't going to flock to see it, unfortunately. Like I said, I went to see this twice opening weekend. The theater was empty both times. And that's a fucking travesty, considering how great this movie is. So yeah.
People bitch about subtitles, man. It's sad but true, but they're missing out on so much cinema by saying that, though.
I was so glad that the director of Parasite made that comment at the Oscars, where he was talking about Americans having the aversion to subtitles. It was so fucking perfect. But you know, finally, a foreign film. Well, not finally, but for the first time in a long time, a foreign film wins Best Picture, and deservedly so. So, yeah, rock on.
Hell yeah! This movie's awesome, though. I love the frog, the giant frog.
Ah, the frog's great. I'm convinced the frog is a metaphor, but I've never been able to pinpoint. I don't know if it's gluttony or something, but that frog represents something, and it's probably going to take someone smarter than me to figure it out.
Same here, man, you know. Oh, it's so great, though. And then it just froze up its whole body. I'm like, what the fuck?
And then there's hanging out there. It's like, wow.
And that's what I love, that it's part of her, you know, three tasks. So you automatically have this mission and that she's going along. So you're kind of got the adventure set up from the get-go.
Oh, yeah. The first two acts of this movie play out almost like an RPG video game, you know? You've got a quest, you've got to go get this key, you've got to find the door that key goes to, you're going to run into crazy creatures, dangerous monsters. I mean, it's literally a video game.
Labyrinth game, yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, I got a question then.
And the gamer just makes me love it more.
Well, in the second quest, when she goes down into the room, and all the fairies are pointing to the middle door, but she goes, no, no, no. And then she goes to the one on the left to get the dagger. Why did she now listened to the fairies, if the fairies were supposed to be, you know, all helpful and everything? Is it just because fairies are supposed to be trickeries and
yes.
fairies are, that's pretty much what it is?
I think yeah. so. I think I'm going to say one of two things. Either fairies are, you know, they're mischievous. You know, they like to fuck with people. You know, Tinkerbell is a perfect example. But as far as them pointing to the middle lock, I want to think that was a test. I feel like that was them testing Ophelia to say, mm-hmm. you know, does this feel correct? I just remember, too,
she had that dream where she drew her hand with the chalk in the middle. And then it didn't work well for her, so that's she right. figured, oh, maybe it's the left one instead.
Yeah, yeah, uh-huh. I love. Yeah, I'm very okay with that.
Yeah, it's like, oh, it just clicked on me.
I'm just wondering what the hell was behind that middle door. Was something gonna like jump out and bite her?
it was gonna be like 400 more pale men. Because holy shit,
another fucking big ass toad.
It was gonna be Videl as the pale man.
Oh. A pale man, though. I mean, especially the first time I saw that, I was like, that is such a creepy but cool-ass creature. I mean, what a creative design.
Excuse me. Yeah, the choice to make him practical, too, such a great decision, because that character's so thin. I mean, he's skeletal thin. If you didn't have somebody like Doug Jones, you'd have to do it CG. And we probably wouldn't be sitting here talking about this movie right now if the Pale Man was CG. Part of his menace is that he feels real. He feels like he's occupying space in the same room Ophelia is standing in. So there's that sense of dread for Ophelia. Obviously, you know, you're not going to think that the star of the movie is going to go down for the count that soon. But there's still that sense of danger that makes that scene very intense. And even though the Pale Man doesn't walk very fast, hey, neither do zombies, and they're fucking terrifying.
Yeah. Very creepily walking, though, stumbling around.
I just feel like that Pale Man fits in great with, like, Hellboy when in part two when he's down to meet the Angel of Death.
Yes.
That Pale Man and that Angel of Death, like, almost feel like they're a shared universe. The way how they both look and how they feel, like when you see the angel, how her eyes light up, feels the same way with the Pale Man with his eyes in his hands and the facial expressions. It just feels like it's like a shared universe between those two characters, that they belong together.
I could see it.
I love that. Yeah, that might be terrifying, but we all know who the real monster of this movie is. And after Videl gets his mouth cut open, he's like, he has like half his
little Joker going there.
He's like, that's the final test, is yes, Videl's the monster. You know?
And what's funny, too, is that for years, I always wondered why Mercedes didn't kill Videl right then and there. Like, she had the opportunity. But then over the years, I realized Videl is so vain that the worst thing you could do to him is fuck up his face. Not killing him, because that would end his pain and he would be done with it. But if you fuck up his face to the point where he has to give himself stitches, that's going to be like the ultimate fuck you to Videl. So,
and
yeah.
Another one, too, with Videl, too, was he was so entrailed with his son. He had to have his son. He had to have the son there. Mm-hmm. And at the end, he goes, tell my son that his father, and she's like, you're not going to even, he's not even going to know your name.
Yep.
His facial expression was like, what?
Exactly. Yeah, oh, that is such an epic line. Mrs. Venom actually applauded when said that to him. She literally flipped off the doll and said, fuck you, you deserve that.
That's another big answer, like his face and his that, but also taking away his child.
Yeah.
That's his two main right there. But I think at the same time, his watch stopped when he got shot, if I remember correctly. And they were talking about his watch the whole entire time. When the watch stops, that's when you know he's going to die.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
It's like, well, that's not a real story. But every time he looks at it and goes, wait, I have this watch. He's always looking at the watch. You always hear the watch ticking.
Yeah.
Like, ah.
And, I mean, Vidal's brutality, too. I mean, it speaks so much to his character.
When he just beats the fuck out of that dude, that bottle.
Oh, God. Oh, and what's funny is that a lot of the kills that Guillermo uses in his movies are kills that he's actually seen in real life. A lot of people would question why the bottle never breaks in that scene. But Guillermo said he actually saw a bar fight where one guy just beat the hell out of another guy with a bottle. And the biggest thing that Guillermo took away from that fight was that the bottle never broke. Despite hitting the guy like a dozen or two dozen times, the bottle never broke.
Some of those bottles are strong as hell. I used to work at a bar and they were solid. You drop that bottle and it's like click, 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 but it doesn't shatter. It doesn't crack. It's solid. Yep. That will just knock the shit out of you.
Yeah.
I just felt sorry for that stutter guy.
He goes,
if you can count to three without a stutter, you're free to go. And then all of a sudden, you know, he does that three, and he just, oh, shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, he just felt so bad.
And that's a lot of Guillermo's, like, more brutal kills in his movies do come from real life. I'm sure you guys have noticed that in a lot, not a lot, but in, like, two or three of his movies, people get stabbed in the armpit.
Yeah,
that actually happened to Guillermo when he was a kid. He was running away from somebody, a bully or something, and he jumped over a fence, but apparently his pants got caught on the top of the fence, so he didn't quite clear it, and he fell armpit first right onto one of the top spikes. And he said it's the greatest pain that he's ever felt in his life, and that's why he has it in his movies, because it's not necessarily a killing blow, but it's so fucking painful that all of his villains deserve it. I love
that. Unless it's on the left side, it's a killing blow. If it's on the right side, it's not.
Gotcha.
Because of the heart, where the heart's located, and the left is all softer. So
right.
If it goes through, you can actually go and pierce the heart through the left side, through the armpit, where the right side is a little bit stronger with the ribs and everything, more protection. So if you get pierced from the right side, you'll be more protected.
Gotcha. I'll make sure to attack from the left now.
I know where to stab now.
Yeah, let's get over here.
I'm learning something. I love this.
Get over here.
Oh,
turn around. You're on my wrong side.
Now, the thing that I always ask myself, and I actually picked up on a few things on this watch of this movie, is there's always that question, is this all in her head or is this really happening? One thing that I notice on watching this is the Fawn gives her the book and she has the book later on in other scenes with other people. I'm like, okay. So that kind of questions me is, the Fawn gave her the book. Are other people seeing the book too?
That's a tough one, man.
She never opened it in front of people. She always opened it when there was no one around.
Right.
That's true too. It's just this movie makes me think. Damn you!
Oh, yeah.
I
always took it as, you know, she's so disconnected with real life. You know, she hates her life. She hates her stepfather. Her mother's dying. You know, there's not really a lot for real life to offer her. So, like a lot of little girls, she just kind of invents her own world. You know, and she just got. Kind of like the movie Bridge to Terabithia. I don't know if you guys saw that or read the book.
I read the book. I didn't see the movie.
Yeah, it's kind of the same thing where the girl gets so involved in her imaginary life that it literally becomes her real life in her own head. So, I mean, obviously, I think both sides of the argument can be, you know, well argued, whether this actually happened or whether it's all in her head. But, you know, just the way that I always took it, especially the scene where she's talking to Fawn and Vidal shows up and he looks and sees that she's talking to no one. You know, you could explain that as, oh, only Ophelia can see these mythical creatures, or that they're not actually there and they're in her head. So, yeah, it's a.
Yeah, the other scene that I noticed on this watch, too, that kind of made me think that it's cool, this movie, because it could either be or not, you know what I mean? In that sense, like you were saying. But the other scene was the Mandrake root thing with the mom, which makes me think, like, because the mom was starting to get better and shit.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then she started to, well, you know what happens later on when it gets destroyed and burned in the fire. And it's, like, fucked up in that sense, you know?
Absolutely, like, yeah.
I think a lot of it's parallel with the original tale of, was it Princess Moana? Princess mm-hmm. Mona. Uh-huh. And I think it even says in the human realm, it's visible only to those who know where to look. So,
okay.
So I think that's a lot of maybe, you know, explaining why they couldn't see the book and they can't see the maybe what she's seeing in every case anyway. But
yeah, I like that aspect of this movie a lot, where it could be real or it couldn't be, and no one would be wrong either way, you know.
Right. Another great thing I love about this movie is even though it's fantasy and there's monsters in it, it's like everything involving the labyrinth and all the crazy mythical creatures, that's not the horror of this film. This film is solidly a horror movie, but the horror is the war. The horror is Ophelia's real life.
Yeah, Ophelia knows. And,
yeah. Ophelia is very aware that she holds no value to her new stepfather. She's very aware that he wants a son to carry on his name, to carry on his father's name, blah, blah, blah. So, and watching her mother slowly die, it's almost like a wake-up call, because she knows if her mother dies, she will not be safe, you know, under the care of Vidal. Vidal will off her, you know, in a second. So, yeah, that's another thing that I love about Guillermo's movies, is that the monsters in his films are rarely the villains. His villains are generally, you know, human. Now, obviously, there's the Hellboy movies, there's Mimic, there's obviously going to be exceptions to the rule. But a lot of his movies, the monsters are actually, you know, the, kind of the protagonists. Whereas there's always, and especially with all three of our movies today, you know, there's a piece of shit human that's really kind of providing the majority of the horror for the film. Mm-hmm. And I just love that.
It takes back to the classic monsters where a lot of the creatures were misunderstood, man.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's Del Toro also, like we I said during the creature show, Del Toro's favorite universal monster character is like the wolf creature, yeah. And it tells you that he always puts symphony inside his movie monsters himself. He's always a... On a side note, before we get into... I think we blew this movie enough. you know, I like listening to Del Toro talk. I wish he'd done a lot more special features on like other releases. Like it's cool that he does like stuff for Zombie, and he's also on the release of El Acaro from Mondo Macabro because he's a huge fan of that film, which he should be. It's Mexican cinema, so it's definitely him looking into the roots of his filmmaking styles there.
Mm-hmm.
And
if you like listening to Guillermo talk, I'm not sure if you listen to Mick Garris's Postmortem podcast, basically just Mick Garris interviewing, you know, horror directors.
Oh, yeah.
Just recently, I'd say within the last month or two, Guillermo was on. He did like an hour with Guillermo, and it is a spectacular episode. Just hearing the stories of Guillermo as a kid, dreaming of, you know, making movies and, you know, making these fantastic things that he sees himself at the cinema. I mean, he's no pun intended, but it's like the American dream. You know, he was a kid who grew up with a goal, and he hit that goal. That's fucking amazing. You know, how many of us can say that? How many of us are actually doing what we thought we would be doing when we were 12, you know?
Nope.
Guillermo is.
Yeah. For real.
That's awesome. All right, let's get into some ratings here. W, you go first.
Nice. Well, as I said, this was my first introduction with Del Toro, and fell in love with him, and loved everything ever since, and then before, but nothing's ever lived up to this one. That, you know, we've obviously blew this one to death, but it is a fantastic film, man. I just love the dark fantasy, taking it back to even Grimm's fairy tales, and as we said, you know, mixing it in with the Spanish Civil War all the way to Greek mythology. There's so many touches and aspects, but ultimately just Del Toro's just showing his craft and his love, and I think this film just sums up Del Toro perfectly. Just much deserving to get a Criterion, man. 10 out of 10, perfect film.
Nice. I probably know what Venom's rank is, but we'll do it anyway. Go ahead, Venom.
Yeah, three guesses what my score is. Yeah, as I mentioned, this movie is perfect to me in almost every way. I've seen it dozens of times, and it still gets that emotional impact at the end, you know. And, you know, when a movie can do that, when I know an ending is coming, but it still gets me deep in the feels, yeah, it is a goddamn masterpiece. And I've always said that Guillermo del Toro is best when he gives us his dark, whimsical fantasy. And this is the absolute perfect example of it. It's dark in the sense that it's set in the Spanish Civil War. It's fantasy, you know, obviously because of, you know, the monsters, the creatures, but then it's whimsical because of multiple, you know, relationships in the movie, Ophelia and Fawn specifically. You know, they have a couple of little whimsical moments, and I just, that's when I feel Guillermo's at his absolute best. Yes, I love Pacific Rim. I've already said The Devil's Backbone is my favorite of his films, but I still think he's most in his element when he's doing stuff like this, the dark, whimsical fantasy. So, with all that said, it will be absolutely no surprise. This is a 10 out of 10. This is the sheer definition of a 10 out of 10 film. So, yeah.
All right. Kind of figured that. All right, Derek.
How can I follow that? I'll just keep it nice and short. Master fucking piece, 10 out of 10. There you go.
Nice.
Ironside.
Yep. All right, for me, this was a first-time watch. And I want to say thank you, Barnes & Noble, for having their 50-50 sale, because I picked it up during the sale. Because I was debating about buying the Criterion or the like theatrical release. I said, fuck it, I'm getting the Criterion. What the hell, why not? And so glad I did. The transfer's awesome, but the movie was fantastic. I hate it when a movie starts with the ending and goes back. But this way works perfect. You don't know it's the ending until it is.
Yep.
At first I thought it was a boy that was laying there bleeding. Then the blood going in reverse back into the mouth, into the nose. And I didn't think about it until at the end. I'm going, oh, there it is. But then we don't get a full ending until we finally see what happens. And you're like, oh, I feel better now.
I feel better and shitty at the same time.
Yeah. First I'm like, oh, that sucks. And I'm like, oh, wait, this is good. Oh, good, good. Again, I love the main villain. He's such a dick. And where his play is perfect. I give this one a 10 out of 10 as well. I had so much fun. I'll be definitely watching this again down the road. Such a fantastic fantasy fairy tale piece with war and horror.
Yeah, man. Like, Dubby, play that funky music, white boy.
All right. We're going to do it the scanner way. I'm going to suck your brain dry. Everything you are is going to become me. You're going to be with me, Cameron, no matter what. After all, brothers should be close, don't you think?
Hello, Ironside. Hell yeah. Well, I guess we're 40, too, though. Yeah, 40. Jesus, that hasn't happened before in a while.
Yeah. Unanimous decision on that one.
Yeah. I say we take a break, and we'll be right back, and I'm going to close the show out with, actually, ironically enough, this was a first-time watch for me, this one.
Wow.
Whoa.
Yeah, so we'll be back in a minute with Crimson Peak. So we'll play you the trailer right now and be right back. Peace.
Ghosts are real. That much I know. I've seen them all my life.
Beware of Crimson Peak.
Would you be mine? Edith, this is my sister.
She's the right choice.
You have to trust me.
Thomas, your bride is frozen.
I'll run you a hot bath.
There are parts of the house that are unsafe.
house as old as this one becomes, in time, a living thing.
Never go below this level.
It starts holding on to things.
Has anyone died in this house? Specific deaths? Violent deaths?
In your own best interest, proceed with caution.
Keeping them alive when they shouldn't be.
If you're here with me, give me a signal.
She has everything.
Do we have to do this? Must we?
Yes. You have no idea what they do.
What do you want? I have to leave.
You have nowhere else to go. This is your home now.
And we are back to close out the Del Toro special, guys. That's right, we're here with the final review of the night. And like I hinted, this is a film that's a first-time watch with me, and that might be a little shock, but I'll explain myself in a few seconds after I give you what it's called and a little plot synopsis. All right, Crimson Peak from 2015. 5 years ago sounds pretty good right now, right, guys? In the aftermath of a family tragedy, aspiring author is torn between the love of her childhood friend and the temptation of a mysterious outsider. Trying to escape the ghost of her past, she is swept away to a house that breathes, bleeds, and remembers. Okay. The first time I saw, like, ads for this movie, I'm like, okay, big Hollywood movie, Tom Hiddleston. I'm like, fuck you, Loki. You know, like he's just everywhere at the time. And, like, I actually kind of like him now. Actually, after Avengers and stuff. And I was like, oh, I kind of miss Tom Hiddleston in these movies and shit. After he got choked hold by Thanos, spoiler. Because I got to like the character more, too, in those movies. But, you know, and I kind of like him. He's in also one of my favorite Ben Wheatley movies, High Rise. Oh, so fucking good, that movie. But, you know, and, you know, Jessica Chastain and fucking Mia... Oh, God, what the fuck is her last name?
Mia Goth?
No, it's not. It's the main girl there, Mia Wasikowska. Oh,
oh. Yep.
Wasikowska. I don't even fucking... Mia W, I'm going to just call her for the rest of the review because I'm not pronouncing that name. I actually like as an actor. You know, she was in, like, Stoker and Tim Burton and Alice in Wonderland movie, which kind of fell apart, but she was okay in it. But, you know, and then I saw Charlie Hunnam from Sons of Anarchy, and I'm like, I know he's British in real life, and it was kind of weird that he was not using his British accent in that King Arthur movie that he's in, that terrible King Arthur movie. It was weird, that movie. He's been in some weird roles. But, you know, I was like, you know, I didn't know about this, and, you know, I was a different person then, too. I didn't get to see a lot of, like, certain types of cinema at the time, and boy, I put this fucker in. I'm like, you know, and plus I wasn't into, before I get into my thoughts on it, it takes me a lot to get into a period piece set sometimes. And at that time period is what I'm saying. But now that I'm a little bit older and a little bit more of a different film style, I like a lot of different types of films now than I did then. Fuck, holy shit, this is like got Nathaniel Hawthorne all over it. like if you guys ever seen like The Innocents or like fucking House of Seven Gables, holy fuck, yeah. The atmosphere is fucking amazing in this movie. It's so gothic horror. This is definitely his love letter to like
The Haunting, too.
Yeah, it's like, if you had a baby with, like, if Hammer movies had a baby with, like, Nathaniel Hawthorne, like, and had a sex together and just fucked, and this would be this movie.
That's a pretty good description.
While Basil Rathbone was videotaping?
Oh, yeah, definitely, man. That'd be amazing. Faster now.
Awesome. You even have Carter Cushing there to tie in with your Hammer influence there.
There you go. Yeah. More Cushing for the pushing.
Call back to last episode of No More Room in Hell, huh?
There you go. I love that line. I'm going to use that on every fucking show I'm on.
But man, great effects in this. The visual style. I love the house. I love how, like, this clay looks like Hammer blood too, which is even amazing.
Yeah, the red clay against the snow, man, is a beautiful visual for sure.
And you know, it's definitely a film that I loved. I loved this fucking movie. This spoiler alert. I fucking loved it. It was fucking awesome. And you know, it's definitely a different. You know, it's definitely goes in back into like those old Universal Hammer, like more romance-y type of, like, more character development and more of a mystery type of movie. And we'll talk about one performance later. Jessica Chastain in this movie, I kind of hit and miss with her an actress in some points because sometimes she just plays the same character over and over again. This fucking role's like, I wish she played more characters like this.
Yeah, she was made to. This really showed her acting chops, man. As you said, I mean, this is the first time I really saw her do something different.
Oh, fucking so good. Debbie, what did you think of this movie, man?
I have to say, I mean, this one's came up. I didn't hate it. I was slightly disappointed. I think I just went into it a little overhyped because I thought it was going to be live up to all these Hammer aspirations and all this stuff for me. But in a way, it did. Like I said, it's grew on me. I just love the Victorian, man. The set pieces and the costume design. He definitely had to go to great lengths to just create this house and just the whole look and aspect of this movie. Definitely a lot of work. Like I said, it's came up a lot for me on this second view, though. I really love the use of CG in this one as well, because I'm the first guy to complain about CG, but Del Toro has got it figured out, man. Yeah. The bleeding effects of these ghosts, I just love that effect, how it just raises up out of their head or wherever they were wounded from.
Oh, yeah, man. We'll get more into those in a minute. Venom, man. What do you think? Yeah.
Let's see. This is another one that I saw opening night, obviously by 2015. You know, Guillermo's solidly my favorite director, so of course I get excited. Now, I'm actually right there with Dub. I was slightly disappointed in this the first time. Not that it's a bad film, not by any stretch. It's a spectacular film. It's beautiful. It's one of Guillermo's best made films. But it was the story that didn't quite work as well for me as I wished it had. It's not a terrible story, but it's kind of cliche, you know, rich or at least presumably rich, you know, tycoon marries a woman with alternative motives, blah, blah, blah. It's a story we've seen before, but obviously not in this kind of setting, you know, with a large mansion on top of a snowy hill. So, you know, the set designs in this are amazing. Someone mentioned the costume designs. The costume design floors me in this movie, especially in the waltz scene. Look at the way every single person in that party is dressed. The trouble that they went through for authenticity just absolutely astounds me. But like I said, I walked away from the film ever so slightly disappointed because I didn't find it as scary as I hoped I would. Obviously, you know, we're all full-grown adults here, and there aren't a lot of movies that quote-unquote scare us that actually, you know, can do something to us unless they're old favorites or something like that. So I understand as a jaded horror fan, I can't go into movies expecting too many scares. But I guess I kind of fell into that trap with Guillermo, you know, with Pan's Labyrinth and Devil's Backbone and everything else. It kind of it kind of set up for a little bit of disappointment. Now, I bought the movie as soon as it came out, and I've watched it over a dozen times over the years, and now I really, really appreciate it more for what it is. Because ultimately, this isn't a ghost story. This is a love story. This is a relationship story. Yes, there are ghosts involved. Yes, there is a haunted mansion involved, but those are all secondary. It's really more about, you know, our two main characters and how, you know, Thomas has a plan, a very nefarious plan to start out. But then as he spends more time with her and with Edith and learns more about her, obviously he falls in love. You know, once again, boy meets girl, boy falls in love with girl, blah, blah, blah. So once again, another basic basic storyline. But the movie is so gorgeous. The soundtrack is so stellar. The effects are amazing. Once again, Doug Jones in a dual role playing the mother ghost and the clay ghost. And the fact that they went with a combination of practical and CG for the clay ghost is amazing. I love that so much because without the blood effect kind of floating out into the sky, it's just another ghost. It's clay, obviously, because, you know, the person whose spirit that is was either killed in a clay pit or their body was dumped in a clay pit after being killed, whatever the case may be. So it totally made sense. But like I said, you add that little bit of CG with the axe, you know, in the top of the head when we first see the clay ghost in the bathtub. And then every time we see the ghost later on, still just gorgeous work, gorgeous creature design on that one. The mother ghost, though we only see her a couple of times, she's kind of a more of a traditional, you know, she's got the wedding dress on, a black wedding dress, so, you know, it's kind of a more of a traditional gothic ghost, but that clay ghost, I absolutely love that spirit. As I've said, I watched it more and more over the years. I've learned to love it. I've come to really appreciate it from its filmmaking standpoints more than its storytelling standpoint. So, yeah, I still really, really enjoy this movie. I can't go so far as to say love, because there's like three or four Guillermo movies that I absolutely love. But I really, really enjoy Crimson Peak. As I said, I've bought it. It's almost an annual watch for me, so... obviously, I like it more than I want to admit, but yeah, still a great film, still incredibly well made. I just wish there was a little bit more horror element to it, and maybe even a little bit more like actual on-screen death, because ultimately, you know, the only people who die are, people who deserve it. And, you know, a great horror movie is when you put innocent people in danger and maybe even potentially take them out every now and then. That's when you really start to get the realism of the horror and the true, like, shock value of, oh, shit, nobody's safe. Anyone can die, good or bad. So, like I said, a little bit more horror, and this movie would probably be pretty close to a 10 out of 10. But as it is, really, really enjoy it. I revisit it often. Love the performances, love the score. It actually got me, just like with Derek, it actually got me to like Tom Hiddleston. I like Loki. Loki's okay. I'm a Marvel fan, so of course I'm going to like most Marvel characters, hero or villain. But this movie was one of the first ones that I really walked away thinking, okay, I like this guy. Even though he plays a total piece of shit who does like a 180 and tries to redeem himself, and he does kind of redeem himself at the end. Ultimately, he does save his wife, Edith. But just... like I said, great little film. Really, really enjoy it. I'm on the cusp of loving it, but I'm not quite there.
Yeah, it might be just too because I've been watching a lot of these movies recently too. Like House of Seven Gables is kind of the same type of movie. It has not really any horror elements to it. It's an old school Universal Vincent Price film where it's about like backstabbing and, you know, the characters are. There's might be a supernatural thing happening too, and it's kind of like a mystery. It's kind of the same thing, and you know that's great because that has Basil Rathbone in it too. Actually, that you made that joke, so it's awesome to see those two together. And actually, George Sanders is in that movie too. Great cast in that one. It's just you know, it's kind of this you know like this is what I'm saying with it. It has like that Hawthorne touch of like movies like The Innocents, like. Where it's more about the characters than it is about the actual ghosts, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Matt, did you see this before?
Yep. Actually, I bought the old, I never saw it in the theater, but I did see it when the first got a Blu-ray release. I bought the theatrical release, and I thought it was pretty neat. I liked the darkness of it, the dark gothic attire. Then, of course, the Arrow got a nice release, and I had to upgrade. I definitely upgraded to that release, and I definitely enjoyed the box set, how it's all set up. Again, it's a very slow burn type film, not a Del Toro we're used to, where this one just seems it's more, I don't know, it's hard to describe, but I did like it for what it was. My wife and I sat there and watched it together. We understood the twist to it pretty easily. It wasn't hard to figure that out, the whole incest. And other than that, it was good. Again, for a second watch, it gets better. So I think with this movie, the more you watch it, the better it's going to get all the time. Yes, it's going to be definitely one of those ones where he starts off, okay, but as soon as you understand what's going on, it gets better and better.
Yeah, and the thing that I actually, like you said, like Jessica Chastain, I love how she becomes like this crazy fucking bitch at the end. Yeah. And you know, the whole incest thing, like I was like expecting that at all. I'm like,
I knew, in the attic? What? Yeah.
You know, like, it was fucking crazy. Like, it's fucking great. And then she's like, I love... this movie's like 5 years old. I don't give a fuck. I'm gonna... Pretty much their whole scheme in this movie, guys, if you... I'm gonna just do a spoiler warning here. So, you know.
Yeah.
They've been doing this for a while and killing wives off and getting the money and shit. He's been married a few other times, and that's who some of the other ghosts are that you see in the movie. And you know, it's kind of fucked up because I'm like thinking, because they kind of don't hide it, because they show the scenes of him and Jessica Chastain talking, like, I thought you killed the dog, you know, like, you know, something's kind of going on.
And they have a weird sexual tension between them too in a lot of scenes.
Oh, yeah, you know, it's like, it's very odd. It kind of reminds me of, like, what's that movie that I watched recently? It was like a Paul Naschy movie or something, where it was like incestual, like, sisters that were fucking Paul Naschy, and they were fighting over it. It kind of reminded me of that. And it was Broken Eyes of a Blue Doll, that's what it was, which is a great Paul Naschy giallo film, if you haven't seen it. Yeah, it's... It has that flavor, you know, and the greatest kill in this movie, though, is the kill to the dad when he gets
on the sink. Brutal. Great.
Oh,
brutal.
Fucking. Mm-hmm. So brutal. And you just, I think actually it's a scene that, it kind of reminded me of the kill in Deep Red that involved the doll and the guy hits his head. And it kind of reminded me of something that Argento said in an interview where, yeah, you get stabbed. Most people don't get stabbed or shot. They usually just hit their leg or hit their head. That's what real pain feels like. So you get that creep, like, oh, you know, like, I know what that feels like, kind of, you know. And you're like, you know, I fell and hit my tooth on a fucking thing before, and it hurt like a motherfucker. And I'm like, and I saw that, I'm like, oh, God, Jesus Christ.
And to think that was Lucille too, that did that. How fucking strong is she?
Yeah.
That's, you would think it was her at first, and then all of a sudden they play that twist, you're like, oh shit.
And that's so effective because, you know, at that point in the film, you set up like 25 minutes of just kind of character development in Victorian lifestyle. So, I mean, out of nowhere, you got somebody just getting their head smashed on a sink. You're like, what the fuck? so effective that way. Yeah.
Yeah.
Black Love Killer, murder mystery, definitely.
Yeah.
It just needed a soundtrack from Goblin and they'd be all set.
Yeah.
A big shout out to the cameo from Jonathan Hyde, too, as the book editor at the beginning of the movie. Yeah. I was like, holy shit, it's the dude from Anaconda and Jumanji. I haven't seen him in years. I'm back to get my notes, Alan.
And then he was in The Strain.
Yeah, the Del Toro show. He was one of the...
Actually a good show, man. I definitely suggest that.
Yeah, I actually, if you didn't know this, the guy who co-wrote this train with Del Toro is Chuck Hogan.
Right.
Yeah, he's from my area. He's a Boston writer.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah. So I actually went to a book signing for him. He's the guy who wrote The Town, the movie The Town.
Nice.
Yeah.
Good writer then, yeah.
Yeah, hell yeah. A.K.A. Prince of Thieves, that's the original novel that Town's based off of. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I love this train, too, and, you know, it was cool. It kind of had, like, that kind of Hammer feel where, you know, you're, like, a famous British actor from the past and have him guest star. Tim Burton did it in Sleepy Hollow when he actually got Christopher Lee in the beginning of the movie. Which is kind of, like, his love letter to Hammer, in a sense, that movie.
I could see that, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, but yeah, Crimson P, like, freaking, this even has, like, some hag-sploitation elements, because when Jessica Chastain puts out that fucking giant butcher cleaver, I'm like, oh shit, Shelley Winters is in the house. I was just picturing either, like, a Betty Davis or Joan Crawford or Shelley Winters running around with one of those giant meat cleavers back in the day. That whole open end sequence is fucking awesome when they're just chasing each other for the snow. It's so great, and it just plays on, like, the way that they're dressed and stuff. She's all in black and she's all in white. Oh, it's great imagery in that scene.
Yeah, really, the use of color in this movie, too, is so stellar. Somebody was talking earlier about the look of the clay in the snow, but did you notice in the at the funeral at Edith's father's funeral, there were two little girls there with bright red hair, and I just loved the way their red hair contrasted on their black dresses, and then the white snow just looked so great. I mean, this is probably Guillermo's most colorful movie. Like, I thought it was Pan's Labyrinth, but after watching it this week, Pan's Labyrinth does have a lot of, like, muted tones in there. Whereas this one, this shit is bright and shiny, and, you know, very few scenes actually occur at night. I just absolutely love that.
Yeah, you could definitely tell he's taking a lot from, like, the Hammer colors with those colors and shit, and even, like, Euro horror in general. I seen a little bit of, like, Jose Ramon Larraz in there, too. Like, early Larraz, not, like, Edge of the Axe Larraz. That's a totally different time period. You know? like Symptoms and, like, Vampires, like, Larraz style with the colors. And, yeah, man. And, you know, like, the connection with Alucarda, this one kind of feels like Alucarda in a way, too. Like, Alucarda is kind of like a movie where it feels most like a play, very play-like in a sense. And I can see this being, like, a big, giant play, this movie, too. Yeah. Small cast, too, you know?
Yeah, I could see
Masterpiece
that.
Theater was R-rated.
And had incest.
Yeah.
Did you guys notice a theme throughout all... And actually, this kind of goes back to the whole vein, the villains in the movies being vain. Did you notice how all three of the movies that we watched this week, there's major facial damage in all of them? Yeah. Guillermo has a real problem with faces, because he likes to stab people in the face, shoot people in the face, make them peel their own skin off their face.
Right under the eye, too, for some reason.
Likes the face. God. Oh, that Vidal kill, yeah, we never even talked about it, but that is, to me, that is one of the most realistic shots I've ever seen. It's not big.
His eye swells, yeah.
Yeah, and that eye slowly rolling up and the blood start to fill it. Oh, my God, that was stellar. So good. It was like a subtle gunshot to the face, but it was perfect to me. Yeah. Anyway, back to Crimson Peak. But again, even this one, I mean, this is probably one of the best facial stabbings I've ever seen in a film.
Oh, when he gets stabbed in the eye,
it's so visceral, but without being gory. And that's another thing about Guillermo that I forgot to point out. His deaths are very violent and very visceral, but they're rarely gory. You know what I mean? We rarely see, like, body parts. We rarely see intestines or people getting decapitated. Yet his deaths are so realistic. We can see them happening in real life, and we wince. I mean, the first time I saw Loki get stabbed in the face, I fucking winced. Yeah, it was rough. The first time I saw Vidal, you know, take that bullet to the cheek, same thing. I'm like, holy shit, that looked like it does something to your psyche. Because you know you're watching a movie, but it looks so goddamn realistic. And I've seen people get shot, unfortunately. I live in L.A., of course. So it's like I've seen it. And yeah, Guillermo nails it. Because it's not a big spray of blood. When, you know, when somebody gets shot in the head with a small caliber weapon, it's just like Pan's Labyrinth. It's just a little hole. You know, the back of his head doesn't get blown out like he got shot with a fucking 357 Magnum. And sometimes you might not even get blood come out of the wound.
We get that in the when I work in the ER, we've had some gunshot wounds and gunshots come in. And a lot of times it's not as gory as it is like in the movies.
Exactly.
Except for one. Two. Sorry, there was two. I had a guy with a shotgun shot to the face.
Oh, God.
And a Magnum to the face.
Woo!
Oh. I could say those, they're close to it from the movies, but
yeah.
If it's a normal little 22 getting shot in the head, no, they're not going to get the head blown off. It's not going to make a big crater. Yep. It's just going to be a little dot, like a little poop, and that's it.
Yeah, exactly, and that's that. I just wanted to point that out too about Guillermo, that his kills are so visceral but not gory. So he can, you know, he's solid. He never has to worry about the MPAA giving him an X or AO rating or whatever NC-17, you know. But the things that he can do in a PG-13 movie are just so cringeworthy that you just want to crawl in a hole.
Takes it back to Hitchcock, man, just being suggestive with the kills and all how it's filmed. It makes it look way worse than what it actually is.
Yeah. In fact, you know, I just love that Tom Hiddleston comes back as Billy Idol at the end.
Oh, I thought that was Johnny Depp in Fantastic Beasts.
I was like, that's it.
I said it out loud. I'm like, that's that Grimwald guy, isn't it?
I was like, white wedding. I thought he was going to be like, hey, little sister, I love you too.
But it's interesting too how the ghosts of people that have been dead for a while were all decrepit and skeletal, whereas the ghosts of our antagonists, they looked fairly fresh. Yeah, obviously, yeah. They both just died. My question is, are their ghosts going to deteriorate over time as well? Or are they going to stay looking like that forever? I know it's a question we'll never get an answer to, but...
It's a good question, yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't pick that up, but that's a good question.
Yeah, and, you know, that is actually a good... I think they will deteriorate, because you can see, like, some of the skin cracking on his face already.
Right.
And stuff in that aspect.
The same way the house deteriorates, so I could see that.
Yeah.
Oh, the house is absolutely a metaphor for their mental state, for the brother and sister's mental state in Crimson Peak, absolutely.
Yeah, her reaction when she walks in that house, like, what?
Yeah, I mean, when you walk in and you see that giant fucking hole right in the middle of the front room, instantly it's like there's something wrong here. Like, most normal people would have gotten that repaired. You know, especially if you're living in a fucking mansion, but... you know, I understand their circumstance. You know, they inherited the house stole the house, I should say, but whatever. So, yeah, that's probably the only possessions they have. So maybe they couldn't afford it. But that says a lot about these guys. They live in a mansion, yet they still kind of live like commoners, if you will. Just, you know, regular middle class people. So, again, a nice little dichotomy there, because the house in Crimson Peak is gorgeous. Like, every room that doesn't have any environmental damage in it is amazing looking. Chandeliers, artwork all over the walls, beautiful Victorian furniture. Like, every room, is gorgeous, except for that main room with a giant fucking hole in it.
even the basement has it just looks good on screen. I mean, it's not necessarily beautiful, but the way the snow is coming in through all these holes.
Yep.
That's such a cool fucking visual, especially when they start fighting down there.
Yeah.
The clay pits are awesome, the way how it all looks.
Yeah, that really House of Haunted Hill vibe is kind of what I got with the pits.
With the acid pit.
See, this is an example of where I wish I could have seen a little bit more. I actually wish we could have seen more of the clay pit, especially because they showed us that one little image of the skeleton kind of rising to the top. I would have liked to have seen more with that. Like, maybe, like, I actually thought what was going to happen was when Lucille followed What's-Her-Face down there, I figured Lady, what was her name? Sharp, is it?
Yeah, Sharp.
I figured Lady Sharp was actually going to come out of the clay pit and grab Lucille. Obviously, if this was like a standard, you know, Hollywood horror film, that might be what happens. But, you know, Guillermo wanted to make his final girl ultra strong, you know, could totally take care of herself, could take out two completely psycho siblings. So I appreciate that as well. But something about seeing spirits get their revenge is very appealing to me. Knowing that that the Lady Sharp or the Clay Ghost, as some people call it, you know, was wrongfully killed in that house, you would have thought that she would have had more of a presence in the villains' lives. But she chose to communicate with Edith, which says a lot. Which says that the ghost maybe wasn't necessarily the most vengeful, but definitely didn't want Edith to fall into the same trap that she did. So, it was almost like a kind of a, I don't know, a sympathetic ghost, I guess, is the best way to put it.
Yeah, she wasn't a... I kind of, you know, I was kind of expecting that in this movie, Venom, to be honest, so I'm kind of glad they didn't go with that route.
Oh, yeah, me too.
and, you know, it led to the great shovel splat. when she smashes her head with that fucking shovel at the end. I'm like, oh, shit.
Was I the only one in the theater yelling, hit her, like, four more times? Like, she hit her. I understand that she hit her and her head split open. I'm sorry. Everything that that girl went through at the hands of those two siblings, she should have taken that shovel and just fucking dismembered her ass. Just to make sure.
Throw her in the machine. Like, that's kind of what I was hoping. That would have
been nice. Or in the clay pit. That would have been cool, too.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you know, either way, the ending is still incredibly satisfying. I have very few complaints about the ending. I enjoyed it. Like I said, I just wish there was a little bit more quote-unquote horror action throughout the film and maybe just a little bit less romance. Like, I know Guillermo loves his romance. His last two movies were solidly, you know, romantic fantasy films. And I don't know. I guess being a grown man, it's not really the kind of thing I want to see in my horror films, but at the same time, I'm not really going to complain about it. I'm not going to say that it was, like, forced or that it didn't feel natural. Obviously, Thomas has done this three times previously, so he's become an expert at being that charming stranger who can get rich women to do what he wants. So, I'm you know, like I said, for the most part, I'm okay with where the story went, but I still would have liked to have seen just a tad more horror, but that's just me.
Yeah. It happens.
Yep.
All right. I guess it's time to get into ratings. And I'll go first, because you probably think I'm going to give this what you think I'm going to give it. But no, I thought it was beautifully executed for what it was. You know, the romance stuff, I think it's because I was watching a lot of those old Universals, and they had, like, that hokey romance shit in it, too. And this one's just done a little bit more better, you know, in that sense. And some of that rushed Universal stuff, because some of those movies are like an hour long, so it's like, it kind of feels like, hello, hey, how you doing, let's fuck, you know, in those movies. But so I kind of liked it in that aspect, plus you mix like all that gothic shit in this, and you know, I enjoyed it for what it was, and you know, I will watch this movie again, definitely. I kind of want to watch this movie more than the movie I have to watch in a few minutes after the show. I told the guys off here, but, you know, so that being said, I give it a 9 out of 10. I think it's nearly perfect for me, but I can see it going up in the future on future rewatches. And, you know, I didn't mind the period setting in this one, which I know is a big detractor on some people that can't watch period pieces, but I think I like them because they're just to see the craftsmanship of making a period piece in sense, too. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Matt, what about you, man?
This one, it gets better with rewatch. Like, if it's a first-time watch, you're going to be kind of, like, a little disappointed with how everything goes. But after you give it some time, rewatch it again, I think you'll find yourself having a little more fun with it and enjoying the story more and finding stuff that you probably missed the first time watch, and then it clicks the second time. I don't mind period pieces at all. I actually love a lot of them. And this one fits perfect. You got that dark, gloomy era. This old decrepit house mansion in the middle of nowhere where the snow's turning blood, but it's actually clay. This just shows a lot of different aspects. Like, that's what it would look like back then. It's not going to be all cheery-eyed last year-wise, because, you know, this year everyone's wearing masks and it all sucks, but but that's how it will work now. Like, back then, that's what they had, that's what they did, and it works. No one's going to be wearing... I always try to find that little hidden, like, are they wearing the right watch or something, or is that a piece that's declared part of it? But Del Toro does his research. Oh, yeah. If it fits in that timeline, he'll put it in. Not just, it looks good. No, he won't put it in there because it probably never happened then. So that's, I like that aspect a lot. The story was pretty cool. Again, my wife and I guessed it right off the bat that they were a whole brother-sister combo and there was incest involved, and we were right. Like, oh, okay, so that's that. Overall, I give this one probably about an 8 out of 10. If I watch it again, my score will go up some more. it's one of those films. It gets better with rewatchability.
Yep.
All right. Dub.
Who?
Dub.
Oh, Dub.
Yeah, so my only... Start off with a complaint, but it's kind of a double-edged complaint. And that's some of the ghost scares. I felt like some of the ghost scares were maybe just a little more Hollywood-ized and a little more generic. Just something jarring and unexpected from Del Toro. But after rewatches, I think that some of them are pretty effective. And I can just understand that he's just trying to make a different kind of film. And I still appreciate his craft. I mean, we've touched the set design. Beautiful. I mean, captures Victorian. The whole setting's just awesome. Arguably might be his best aesthetically looking film. And it's could be his most gorgeous film, honestly, as far as visuals go. As we said, it's his brightest film and most colorful. Yeah, I'm still coming in at like an 8 out of 10 on this one. It's went up each time I've watched it, so I'm going to continue to give it a shot, man. I've been highly enjoy this one.
Nice. Venom, take us out of here, brother.
All right. Well, as I said earlier, and it's been echoed by multiple folks, the movie is cinematically gorgeous. I mean, the cinematography is stellar. Some of his best cinematography ever. The characters are, you know, either really likable or really hateable, depending on, you know, what they're supposed to be. So, you know, it fits. Their characterizations fit their character. So, as I said, cinematography, set design, the spectacular costume design. I mean, the costume design in this movie is Oscar-worthy. It really is. I mean, if a movie like Sense and Sensibility can win an Oscar for costume design, there's no reason this movie shouldn't as well. So... but as I've already said, the weaknesses in this movie, for me, is in its storytelling. It's a very basic story. It's been mentioned that you kind of see the ending coming, you know, brother and sister, incestual, killing off rich women. It's just, you know, it's a fairly color-by-numbers formula, but the way that Guillermo does it, he's still able to put his originality on it, his fantasy aspects. I mean, some of the scenes in this movie are legit terrifying. When the clay ghost comes out of the floor the first time, that's fucked up. Like, I would shit myself if I saw that. So, yeah. You know, a lot of really good CGI effects, a lot of good, well, the clay ghost was practical. The mother ghost was all CG, but it was still Doug Jones kind of wearing the motion capture suit. Mm-hmm. So he is still in a dual role in this one, just like, Pan's Labyrinth. But as far as the score goes, I'm going to come in with the same score that I gave to, Kronos, and that's going to be an 8.5 out of 10. But whereas Kronos earns its 8.5 by its stellar storytelling and performances and writing, this movie earns its 8.5 with all the visuals, costume design, set design, cinematography. It's just a wonder to behold. It's definitely Guillermo's most beautiful film. So it's definitely one that I think people need to see on like the largest, you know, highest resolution screen they can get to, because this movie is just, every frame is almost a work of art. It's gorgeous. So yeah, 8.5 out of 10 for me.
Nice, nice. Hell yeah. Del Toro show out of the way, guys. Woohoo! Venom, thanks for joining us, man.
Absolutely. You sound happy that you're done with the Guillermo show. I'm kind of sad.
It took a lot of research prepping and, you know, getting the films together and stuff. And, you know, we actually were going to do this show, the last show, but then we moved it, you know.
Well, so, I think good for me.
Good for you. Hell yeah, man. You know, definitely more Del Toro in the future. This is definitely going to be a volume 2 of this.
Oh, has to.
Nice.
Sometime in the world. And you, even like, well, actually, some of his movies are fucking, actually like sequels and part of trilogies and shit.
He's technically only directed one sequel to his own film. Even though he directed Blade 2, Blade wasn't his movie.
Yeah.
So Hellboy 2 is technically the only sequel to his own film that he's ever done. And as far as I know, it's the only sequel he'll ever do. He's recently in some interviews, he said that, yeah, he just doesn't like the franchise concept. He wants to do, you know, individual, you know, pieces of art to be enjoyed, you know, either individually or as a group, but not necessarily having like a narrative that follows them all, you know, together. So
yeah.
Even though we mentioned how two of his movies are kind of in a shared universe, only because they both take place in Spain, very close to each other, and they're both at opposite ends of the Spanish Civil War. Devil's Backbone is the beginning of the Spanish Civil War, whereas Pan's Labyrinth is closer to the end. So, yeah, I mean, like I said, I you guys got to shut me up because I could talk Del Toro for hours.
Yeah. But before you got anything, what's new and improved coming out and what's out recently that you could talk about for you guys?
All right, so.
Go ahead.
Let's see. So on my main show, which is No More Room in Hell with Mike Merriman and, of course, Mr. Derek B., our last episode, we looked at a couple of under-discussed horror anthologies from the 70s and 80s. On the next episode, we're going to be looking at a couple of Italian films, which are Mr. Derek B's picks. On the next episode of Fresh Cuts, we will be reviewing... And I forgot the name of the damn movie. It just dropped on Shudder. It's like Emporate or something like that. I think it's an Indonesian film.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be Monday on Fresh Cuts. Underwater Kaiju from Outer Space, once again, a show I do with Mr. Derek B. On our last episode, we looked at Paul Gasari, the North Korean kaiju film. Yes, I said North Korean kaiju film. And on our next episode, I believe, what did we decide on? Destroyer?
We're doing Destroyer.
Yes, Godzilla versus Destroyer. The only one where Godzilla dies at the end. So look out for that one. Spoiler. So look out for that one. That was the end of the Heisei series, right?
Yes, it is, yep.
Yes. So, yeah, so look out for that one sometime in August on It's Not Horror, Okay?, my movie commentary podcast that I do with a few folks from NFW and the Friday Nightmares podcast. On our latest episode, which isn't out yet but should be out early next week, we looked at the 1986 John Woo action classic A Better Tomorrow. And this was actually a first-time watch for me, so, you know, I had a lot of interesting questions, so check out that one. I am a huge John Woo fan. I just never got around to watching A Better Tomorrow, despite always hearing great things about it. And after watching it, you know, with the guys for the commentary, I fucking love that movie. Absolutely love it. It may be my favorite John Woo, but that's a story for another podcast. And then last but not least... In the Mic of Madness, which is myself, the lovely Rebecca Reinhart, and Brad Thornton from the Coffin Grounds Facebook group. So we are in the middle of our Frank Henenlotter retrospective. We've already done Brain Damage, Frankenhooker, and Bad Biology. We're going to finish the retrospective with the Basket Case trilogy. That'll be recorded in 2 weeks, and hopefully it'll be out shortly after that. But our latest episode on Brain Damage did just drop this week. So if you're a fan of Frank Henenlotter, check out the last few episodes of In the Mic of Madness. That particular show is available on the Prescribed Films Podcast Network. And I've got some other stuff in the works, but nothing really worth announcing yet. Yes, I am on way too many podcasts, and I will never learn my lesson. So what are you going to do?
Keep yourself busy, man. Hey, you have the perfect time to do it, too. You know, like,
it's true.
Your wife works nights and stuff, so you're like, I'm not doing anything anyways, you know.
Oh, yeah, if it wasn't for podcasting, I would have gone insane weeks ago in this pandemic. Absolutely. Horror movies and podcasting have definitely kept me sane these last 5 months.
Yeah, and I'm actually not sure what the next Cinema Attack show is. We might have to talk off-air about that.
Mm-hmm.
So we might talk about that, but we'll have something coming for you guys in the future. I have a few idea storms that run through the guys, but we'll do that off-air, I think. And I don't know what the hell are we going to leave you off with. But we'll leave you off with something. W, you pick something awesome, man.
I'll do it, man.
All right.
Make it work.
We'll do it. You're doing it and doing it. Not that again. We did that for the Studio Ghibli show. Remember that? That was hilarious. We just left off with the LL Cool J song. For
might as well. Like
family anime movie podcast.
Hey, now, we just talked about a Mexican director. How could the outro music not be Mexican?
Come on. New Los Lobos or something, man. I'd be down.
All right. There you go. And, Del Toro's out of here. We're going to be getting out of here, guys. Check out some Del Toro films and check out a lot of other great Mexican horror movies. Mm-hmm. Awesome shit, man. We're going to get out of here. Peace.
Adios.
Bye.